join us as we cover many an insane movie and numerous cult TV phenomenons. Are you ready to get jacked up? Are you with us? Then listen on.
From the streams with your bare hands, people with cash on hand.
Within a year, Deadwood and these hills will be annexed, and we will be restored to the bosom of the nation.
Does bosom mean dead?
Same thing.
Throughout Deadwood, comely whores, decently priced liquor, and the squarest games of chance in the hills remain unabatedly available 7 days a week.
That is Mrs. Alma Garrett, whose husband purchased a gold claim for $20,000.
I suppose a community such as this attracts a certain kind of man.
Nobody's drinking, nobody's gambling, nobody's chasing tail. I have to deal with that.
Get along with people, turn a dollar, look out for yourself. Just don't wait too long.
You're gonna find out something now about yourselves and your fellow man.
You may run for a long time. Run.
And fuck the future!
You cannot fuck the future, sir. The future fucks you.
Welcome to fucking Deadwood!
It'd be a pity not to recognize what's at stake. To go ahead and die stupid.
Hate to end a fool.
It's a pleasure to see you again.
Must be my lucky day.
Considerable time since seeing you.
Some putting odds up, train to bring you home in a box.
The senator from the great state of California, George Ambrose Hearst.
You murdering, thieving cocksucker.
Outlier Deadwood days are over.
Walk with the future.
Hearst won't take long, for he honors the rigors of his putrid fucking nature.
Back my bid for buying Utter's property, and I will drop any counteraction against the whore.
Moving us from the center of town, away from danger.
I hate running from him, Saul.
If it ain't for Hearst to follow the law, why the fuck should it be for you?
My job ain't to follow the law, man. My job is to interpret it.
I'm not made for such complexity.
Coming for you, Marshal.
Expect you will, Senator.
Alrighty, let's rock our engines. Ready to rumble. We got author Lindsay G. back.
Hello.
Hello. And we got Dean and Eric from the 3324 podcast. How are
Hello.
You?
Hello.
Hello. So, just decided. I always individually just will toss out some franchises because I'm tired of rescheduling and just having a bunch of people not sure if they want to go through all five installments or whatever. And I was like, and this was just one that stuck out to all three parties here. And I was just like, nice. It's like, we could do this because this is not just a neo-Western. This is just like a historical drama. This is a unusual character study. This is a moody piece as a whole. So, Lindsay, since you were first one up to nominate doing this show, what was your first intro to this uncanny setting?
Well, actually, I think that Deadwood, the TV show, was on TV right around the time that I was actually living about 2 hours south of Deadwood, South Dakota.
That's wild.
I was living on the Pine Ridge Lakota Reservation for a year, and I was doing volunteer work there. And so I was very excited that there was going to be this, you know, prestigious show about an area that I actually knew quite a lot about. But because I was very poor and just out of college at that point, I didn't have any way to access HBO. So it actually wasn't until years later that I was able to watch it. And I'm really kind of glad that I put some time between when it came out and when I watched it, because I think living on the Pine Ridge Reservation, I was learning so much about Lakota culture and the history of, you know, the quote Wild West. And in the years since then, I've learned even more. And I think by the time I started watching Deadwood, I knew a lot more than I did at that time. And it really helped me understand the show better, I think. So, I have this show really has a very big place in my heart, I guess.
Totally. That's wild. So you probably were encountering so many people saying, I knew your ancestors, kind of.
Well, the cool thing about, I mean, this is probably a rant for later, but I'll just say now that the interesting thing about Deadwood is there's virtually no Native American characters in the show, which is pretty standard for a Western, you know, starring mostly white people. But I feel like the way that they did it, the setting was extremely important, and the fact that Deadwood was kind of this outlaw town in the middle of a disputed area that was literally part of a war zone for a long time. You did have that feeling throughout the show, and I think that was pretty cool.
It definitely felt diverse despite not always having enough minorities. I mean, you had the Chinese and the some blacks, but yeah, I totally understand what you mean, where it's just like, yeah, it would have probably come into play one way or another.
Yeah. All right. But I always felt like they had the native population was always felt even when they weren't on screen. I don't know. We can talk more about that later. Go ahead.
No, that's good. That's a good starting point. So Eric and Dean, so Dean, you said earlier you had seen like DVDs, you didn't have access to any bootleg cable. And Eric, what was your first turnaround with this?
Actually, Eric had the DVDs. I saw it when it was on. It was smack in the middle of the Sopranos era.
Yeah.
And that was like must-see TV as far as cable TV went. So I think HBO felt maybe they had lightning in a bottle of everybody's watching the Sopranos, it's compelling TV, and this other show comes out, Deadwood. So they had kind of a built-in audience for the people that were watching that type of content on HBO. And I was smack in the middle of Sopranos, and a new show comes out from HBO. I'm like, oh, okay, I gotta watch it. And yeah, I've always been a fan of Westerns and, you know, some of the, you know, Tombstone and Wyatt Earp and Unforgiven and all that stuff. So it kind of was in a somewhat similar vein. And I was there from the word go.
For sure.
Yeah. I'm kind of with Dean on that. This was a really great time for TV anyway. I mean, we had, you know, not just on HBO, but you had things like, Ron Moore's Battlestar Galactica reboot, which I absolutely was head over heels mm-hmm. in love with.
I came home every Friday. My folks are watching that and Stargate back to back, and they're like, "You better be quiet because we can't, you know, TiVo this and rewind it." And they talk. Yeah. They're just like the characters on X-Files in 24, where they talk, mumble very quietly, and then you
right.
turn it down, turn it up, and then blam, crash, kaboom.
But it was I mean, if it wasn't this, you know, it was reality TV. So there was this sort of long form,
yes.
you know, storytelling happening at this point in time, which was really exciting. And there seemed to be something for every genre at this point. You know, you already had shows like, I think, Oz, you know, come out and, you know, things like that. But then this is ever since 9/11, there's this sense of like bringing more authenticity to whatever the subject was, you know, at the time, and making it more real and gritty and darker.
Walter Hill directs the pilot, so you know they're talking business. He right. done a flop with Jeff Bridges years ago. I think Keith Carradine even has a brief part in it, like he did most of his movies. Bill, and I was like, but this is more.
He was my favorite. One of my favorite characters. When they killed him off, I was like, damn it.
right.
Yeah, because I
went in there empty-minded too, and I was like, I had no idea. You know, like, I'm sorry. You know, I've been to Western museums before, but I've always kind of just, you know, grown up watching just anything, just whether it was Western shows or just even popular blockbusters like Tombstone and Young Guns. And it's like, I knew they were always going to take free license, but I was okay with it because it was a Wild West legend. So, you know, no one was ever 100%. But I know what you mean, where it's like, yeah, I mean, even though he's been dead, you still feel like he's there somewhere. The souls watching over them saying, boy, how did you guys really do need me now? Pussies. I was really surprised to know that Greg Feinberg had worked with as a producer on Twin Peaks. And I have no doubt, I can't confirm, but I have no doubt that Mark Frost, the co-creator of that, had worked on Hill Street Blues years earlier with David Mills. So I'm sure he put his name in the hat saying, call this guy up, he's your dude. Mm-hmm. And but I find that so interesting, just go from Twin Peaks to this. It's like same kind of scenario, uncanny town with, you know, colorful characters.
Yeah, very similar
disturbances.
Yeah, true.
But yeah, there was a bunch of other big names I was really surprised to see. I'd seen a bunch of other people who had worked on a few other things, but yeah, this is pretty much, Miltz is just basically at the third stage of his career, and he's just using a lot of the same writers and supporting actors that he used on NYPD Blue, and just like, yeah, and you're going to play this character, and you're going to play mm-hmm. that, and, you know, doing even a Wikipedia, just comparing and tries, is like, yeah, I can totally see why they, you know, compared and said, yeah, I think you can play this character, and you do look somewhat like the photo, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't become like every other biography that you watch now, and you're like, not even close. But no, yeah, that is a good point, how it's everyone's always kind of sort of known about it, that you've always seen clips at the award shows or just in general when there's a special about groundbreaking TV shows. I always heard about it. Ian McShane, we were always kind of recognizing and everything. We're like, oh yeah, that's that one guy who's always, you know,
Mr. Stuck Up. He was so good. So good.
Well, that's the thing. You know, you get attracted names like I mentioned, BSG. I mean, Ron Moore started on Star Trek, so I was a big fan of Star Trek. So, that was just a no brainer for me, because I actually was a fan of the original series back in the 70s, you know, as a kid. And then I was like, yeah, I really enjoyed his writing.
So that's a good contrast, because that was another one, like, both those are mentioned in Men in Hard Times, talking about people making rare breakthroughs in the TV from the 80s to today. And that was kind of the same way, where everyone was kind of saying, oh, why bother, you know, you're remaking a campy 70s show. And it's like, they got some free promotion through conventions back when that was first becoming kind of a thing again. Yeah. And by Edward James Olmos just kind of did some reverse psychology, where he's like, anyone who wants the 70s Battlestar, turn away. And everyone was, they took the bait. They're like, oh, I'm going to check this out now.
He refused to do the show. If I see any anything with three eyes or six six arms or whatever, I am going to faint on set and I am going to leave the show because that's not what I want to do. And he was, you know, so it was a very human take, you know.
So but, true, because like even though this is made kind of similar to a Western show where it's on a set and everything, it doesn't. Everyone forgets the production was not that same way. And that's a good point. Those sci-fi shows is like, even though they were similar and even had a few people doing calls out to earlier 70s, 60s cult hit shows, they were not the same way, even though they were kind of a love letter at the same time. So yeah, that's very true. Is like, and I can kind of see how much like Oz, which I think is another underrated HBO gem, is owned by Rice Entertainment.
Yeah.
Which I think has also coincidentally gone to Viacom. This is also co-owned by Paramount. So I think that's kind of why it was kind of a Fox CBS kind of move, where it's just like, we don't want to fund this anymore because they're getting half the profits so far. Mm. So, but I do know that the guy, Christopher, what's his name, who was like head of HBO, he was kind of a shady character. He got in trouble years ago for like doing some bitch slapping on a girlfriend, and he was also kind of on the record as echoing that many of he and his colleagues didn't necessarily, they're like, just because it's on our station doesn't necessarily mean we like it. So they were kind of bad mouthing Sex and the Sopranos. So it was like,
yeah,
well, gee, you hack, you are on
here. Yeah.
Don't air it if you don't want actually love it, you know. It's just like,
biting the hand that feeds.
Yeah, absolutely. He's now the head of Stars, and they're doing similar shows now.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Power. Right. So it's just like, so I think he's embraced it now, but it's like, fuck you, seriously. If I'm going to greenlight something, I better actually, you know, make it for a crowd that's going to give me my money back, or, you know, take passion in it, you know, instead of just be like, yeah, well, it was easy money.
Yeah.
Now,
well, I wonder though if Deadwood was easy, like ever had the chance of being easy money. You know, it was because it was a Western that really took sort of the poetry that you always want out of a Western and just like pushed it as far as it would go. It was so high-minded, and the way it was written and performed was just. I mean, it was hard to even follow along with. Sometimes I'd be watching a show and like, you know, maybe I had too many beers while I was binge watching it. And I'd be like, what the hell are they even talking about right now? Like, it felt like I was watching a Shakespeare play sometimes.
Yeah, if you're not paying attention, you know, to every scene, if you look away for whatever reason and leave the room just to go, you know, get a drink or whatever, come back and it's like, what just happened? You got to go back and.
Because
it's that detailed. It's that, you know, these characters are all they're all going through all their crises, and this very existential thing happening in all these shows that are just kind of like, you know, they're dealing with problems, and this is ambiguity. This guy's not really a hero. He's not really a villain. It's they all have their issues, and you know, you really got to keep up with it.
I did too. I had to have like kind of a Wicca in front of me, a glossary while I was watching it, you know, and
smart.
And well, I take notes during everything because there's going to be something that comes out. Like right now I'm watching the Isaac Asimov Influence Show Foundation, and that's another one. It's like, okay, there is no, you know, and my mother's the queen of that. I'm just going to reset the oven and be right back. I'm like, do your thing. This is pause because you're going to ask me 500 questions that they will explain for you. And I'm not doing that right now. I want to enjoy this too. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think to Lindsay's point about the high-mindedness of Deadwood, I think what brings that to the forefront is, I think when people are going to watch, especially coming from the era where The Sopranos was and you're expecting this over-the-top violence, it's not like watching Tombstone where this gunfights every episode and people are swirling their guns around. Like, it's not that type of show.
Yeah.
It is more of a dramatic thing where guns are kind of a tool of the trade every day, but it's that they show is not like that.
Yeah. Matt, where it's just like, if there's going to be a gunfight, it's going to end a subplot that's been going on for 5 episodes.
Yeah.
It's not going to be, it never, like you say, yes, Lindsay is on the point. This is never formulaic. And like you guys have said, it and Battlestar kind of got in just because after the stuff started getting edgy in the late 90s for what you could or couldn't show, you know, after 10 o'clock on both regular and cable and pay channels, you know, they started taking notice and just saying, okay, well, now we got to film everything just like a movie and have bigger name talent, have a bit of everybody, whoever we can afford.
Right.
And, but no, I mean, yeah, you there's cursing, but you never feel like it's a, you know, over the top stand up concert where it's like, okay, I get it already. And even though there is other content, there's never, it hardly got to the point of where Game of Thrones is, where you're like, this might as well be an adult porn. It's like, no, this is not like that.
Yeah.
Even anywhere close to that.
The many, many scenes where Swearengen is getting a blowjob, you never actually see the blowjob. You just know it's happening.
And he makes it darkly amusing. And I mean, if you're familiar with Milch working with Steve Bochco, I'm sure Bochco was constantly sending him emails saying, congrats, I never went that far. Disturbing comedies and shows.
Who knew you could use the word cocksucker as literally every part of speech?
Yeah, without getting an X rating.
Right?
Now, Reinhold Heil is a German-born musician. And I noticed he had worked on movies like Run Lola Run and Cloud Atlas. And like, that kind of explains why this kind of has unusual kind of banjo. It's hardly the kind of cliche that I would see in a John Wayne over the top, you know, movie. Like, they use original music. You actually believe it's all authentic in the moment. Like, it's just as key as the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt like this. It was ever self-indulgent. Like, there was a storyline that, I don't know where this is going. You all kind of know it's going somewhere. And I mean, going even back to other points that Lindsay was addressing about how there's not many Native American characters, how there's not many, shall we say, just not very well-esteemed, you know, positions for anybody. There really isn't much of anything. You can basically work for the unofficial marshal. You know, you can work, you know, again, for the bars or the whorehouses. They all kind of go all together. And I mean, this addresses just so much stuff that it does make you wish other stuff would, you know, they never want to talk about this. They all want to, again, instantly just get to the gunfights and being tortured by, again, bandits. And it's just like, here we're seeing mental retardation, you know, addressed by the various residents, especially at the innkeep. Is like, yeah, they're all limping. The smallpox, and this is like, you get it.
I especially love Brad Dourif in this series. Mm-hmm. He was extraordinary as the doc. Yeah. I think it's probably his best role. You know, you've seen him in all these, you know, these really eccentric type roles, sure, or he's a villain or whatever, but I really enjoyed every scene he was in.
You know, he always played crazy guy or just idiot villain. And I guarantee you, he probably loves it too. I've been fortunate enough to see him at conventions along with his daughter, Fiona, who's kind of gotten to the same kind of shtick as him. And I think that's a good way of putting it, where at this point, you know, he couldn't go wrong, and he was able to at least just do a different kind of characterization. And I mean, seeing him do this back to back with Lord of the Rings, I do definitely think gave him.
Oh, he's still very batshit crazy, but he's he's
probably taking who knows how much of his own overdose medicine just to get through the day and not get depressed. Yeah,
his humanity in this thing was terrific. You know, and that's what I liked. You know, the humanity in everyone. In every character, basically. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And they they very much evolve. Like, one season they're annoying, the next season they are very much just like kind of becoming a bigger thing about the town. And it's especially hysterical seeing the stage promoter, Langrish, played by Brian Cox. And it's like how he went from this to later now on Succession, you know?
Yeah.
Being a mad scientist role on Born Identity and X-Men, is like all these roles is like, this is probably the most colorful of his earlier career, I think, just because he's like, well, howdy do, I'm gonna give this town a makeover, and you're like, this is the worst possible town you could ever
Oh, Deadwood is still a gambling town, by the way, and that's where they have the Sturgis motorcycle rally days. Yeah, that's where it happens. So when I moved to South Dakota, it was right around the time of the Sturgis rally, and there were bikers coming in from every direction, bikers everywhere on the roads to Deadwood. And so that's how I actually got to Deadwood the first time, was a few of my other volunteer friends and I drove up there because we just wanted to take in the spectacle of Deadwood and, you know, just bikers everywhere. Everyone's drunk. It was a scene. And since then, the Sturgis Rally has become like a super spreader event 2 years in a row. You know,
it's like, dear,
this town just
this sums up.
Sounds like nothing has changed.
Yeah,
everybody comes roaring into town drinking. Yeah. Right, they're roaring in on their motorcycles instead of horses, and they're coming in drinking. And
yeah, so I mean, they've really embraced their past as their identity. So like, on Halloween now, they have ghost tours. And I think on like the anniversary of Wild Bill's death, they do a reenactment every year.
I do recall that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's a big tourist town, and, you know, well done to them. But I think like the thing that the show really gets to for me is that at that time, technically, no white people were not supposed to be in the Black Hills at all. Legally speaking. Mm-hmm. They were not permitted to be there. Gotta, and the show takes off right after Custer was killed in Montana. And so the legalities were sort of being molded at that time. And, you know, some people just showed up in Deadwood and found some gold there and said, well, you know what? We live here now. This is our land. But it really was not anybody's land. It was under dispute. And I feel like what we've been talking about of kind of the constantly rising tension of the show that's punctuated by some gunfights and some violence, but it's not drenched in violence. I feel like tension really works because, I mean, none of these people were legally here. They had no flag to fly. They weren't technically part of any country. They were trespassing on the land that was supposed to be the Great Sioux Nation, but they were not Sioux. So I feel like the whole show, like there is this really existential dread of like, what's going to happen? Are we going to become part of South Dakota? Is South Dakota going to become part of the United States? There were supply lines. They could get most of what they needed, but when smallpox showed up, they didn't have everything they needed. They didn't have even the people that they needed to care for the sick. And I love how in that moment, you see Brad Dourif's character, the doctor, really step up and be like possibly the only decent human being in town.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Until Calamity Jane, the drunk, shows up and helps him. And it is just the most beautiful, heartbreaking scene to realize that, you know, these people who, for all intents and purposes, are trespassing on this land, and many of whom are acting that way, still have a heart. You know, and they still want to help people.
I'll tell you, I don't think it was so odd. I was seeing George Hirsch because I had read all about the documentary on how, you know, he was the inspiration for Orson Welles.
I think it's funny these characters like Swearengen and Seth Bullock have no problem fighting amongst each other and bickering. But like Lindsay said, when there's a bigger issue about maybe being annexed or the government getting involved, they all come together.
Yeah.
You know, they can fight and bicker and punch each other. But when there's a bigger threat like Hearst or when the government is thinking about what they're going to do with them and take over, they come together, put everything aside to deal with the bigger problem.
Yeah.
I totally concur. I think, and that's just a good, very rewarding perspective from a narrative standpoint to have that kind of predicament, you know, everything comes full circle. So it doesn't just feel like you're just, you know, making this up as you went along. And I mean, everyone's definitely very just comfortable just all bringing these to life. It's especially fun seeing Brahm, Alma's husband in season one, you know, played by Lassie from Psych, and Bosch himself, Harry Bosch, Titus Welliver is one of Swearengen's, you know, uncanny, is like he's a messenger at first forum between him and another guy he's bickering over, and then he ends up becoming his right hand. It's like, that was a plot twist. I'd like to know if that was inspired or if they, and I mean, this show, I had seen Rome, which came later, but I mean, that when that was first pitched, it was often told make Deadwood, but during Roman times. And so I do kind of like how this kind of inspired a bunch of people to just start making a bunch of historical kind of fiction, but not getting too over the top. Some of them did later on. And this one, I think, just wanted to just be like, okay, so the stuff we're going to, you know, do for plot's sake, you know, you can see why we had to change a few things up. Like Trixie is going to be married to this one guy who did become a sinner, but in real life wasn't married. But let's just say for this purposes, he was. So it's like, okay.
Yeah. And, I guess the good thing about it getting, getting unceremoniously canceled so early is that it didn't really get a chance to jump the shark and wear out its welcome. As sad as I am about the three seasons, the great thing about it is it's only three seasons, and you're getting just an amazing watch of these episodes where they each season they built better, and it didn't get to that tipping point of now what do we do when we're on the other side of it, because they never got to the other side of it. So they really were just kind of built this whole universe of people and added, like I said, added Brian Cox and Garrett Dillahunt came in twice. You know, he played Jack McCall, and then he comes back in the second season as the serial killer guy. Yeah, so,
he's always been just kind of the go-to for playing like a deputy or a serial killer, and just seeing him just play both those roles, and they made him look so differently. Yeah. You really do forget this is the same guy.
I was literally like, they really couldn't just hire somebody else. I mean, he's a great actor, but I'm like, he was just literally a significant character in the first in the first season. Like, he was throughout and not just a background character. And then all of a sudden he shows up in season two. I'm like, oh, there he is again.
The movie claimed he also plays like a drunk given a Calamity Jane hell at one point. But I had no problem spotting him. So what do I know?
I think they pretty much brought everybody back. It's, you know.
Yeah, they probably threw him a bone. So yeah.
Yeah.
Come on, set. We'll find something for you to do.
Right. Oh, totally. And I know Lindsay definitely wants to talk about Calamity Jane. That was just brilliant casting. It's like, I never knew, Robin Weigert just playing just so against type, and just, I don't know anyone else who would be brave enough to do that kind of role. Cause you know, we were kind of having crappy, you know, casting back in the day where everyone was like, oh, you gotta look, everyone's gotta look pretty, and it's just like, well, this is none of these people are pretty, so
no.
We're a historical piece, so and do you feel like most of these people who are portrayed are playing kind of the best versions of these outlaws for the most part, or historical legends?
I think so. I think what's extraordinary is just the production design in general, the grittiness of it, everybody's dirty. Everybody's the mud in the streets, it's very visceral, and you just kind of, you believe in this world. So no matter what happens in the show, at least you got that to draw you in. And it's like, okay, this is interesting, you know? So no matter how many times they say the F word and this and that, which sometimes, you know, it's a little much. It's like, you know, yeah, I don't think they talked this way back in the day. But I think, Dean, you pointed out, we talked about this earlier in the week. I think you had pointed out that back in the day, terms like goddamn and things like that were a big deal.
That was a big deal back then. So
saying saying fuck is like, that's up in the ante, you know, because it's HBO and they, you know, we have to get it, you know, we have to go that far, you know, but boy, every other word, you know, but it's a lot of, it doesn't seem gratuitous in that way. Like you really feel like this character, like Swearengen. I mean, you know, this is just the way, this is who he is. This is how he talks. Mm-hmm. And that's part of his language, and that's testament to a remarkable actor like Ian McShane to do this, you know. Yeah, so you really believe in that character. So to your point, Cam, is I think everybody who played in this thing was
this is make it or break it. You know, some of them are at the second or third stage of their career, and some of them are at the beginning of their career. They've just been like a guest star, you know?
Yeah.
And you see their later choices on. It's like, I totally understand. Like, I think this is why Gerald McRaney has only been playing villains. He is never playing Simon and Simon again, you know? And again, we're talking about Trixie, Paula Malkison, you know, she's on Vinaba and other similar moody shows like Sons of Anarchy and Ray Donovan. And I've never seen even Stephen Tobolowsky as a crooked commissioner. You know, he's always the funny guy. So it's like, okay, that's very against point. There's a bunch of other guys who I mean, I've seen him in other later productions, and I can see why this got them more roles, like especially W. Earl Brown as what's his name?
Dan Doherty.
Dan Doherty, yeah.
Dan.
And the guy he fights against in that brutal fight was an actual stuntman who'd been in various movies. So it's like, yeah, all the casting of this makes sense.
That was
brutal. Oh, totally. I know they interviewed, believe it or not, the uncredited extra who's actually seen Unclothed in the opening credits every episode. And she talked about how it was like 70 degrees during the day and then like 30 degrees at night. Personally, I would be pissed off if I was the art director who had to rebuild the set when they made the movie years later.
Right.
And personally, I also want to know, I want an updater on the F-bomb counter. It's like, because it's definitely not less than 3,000.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Updated for the movie. But I do understand what you're saying. It's just like, the dialogue just definitely felt like very more naturalized, even though they were taking creative license. It's like, well, see, I'm cool with that versus, because like, I remember getting pissed off when I saw the Return to Yuma remake. I was like, I sincerely doubt anyone talks this way back then. You know, it's like, at least Django Unchained wasn't trying to be, you know, historical. That was just Tarantino being stupid.
I think the cursing is more like, I think of it almost for this show as punctuation. Mm-hmm. Because the characters are not stupid. Like Al Swearengen is not a dumb guy.
Right.
No. So it's not like that. This is the only way he knows how to talk. I think that, you know, I think they're more like kind of inflections and punctuation to get their point across of either frustration or they use the same word. Yeah. Like you said, in different tenses and in different ways, depending on the situation. So I never thought of it as, oh, they're just not smart characters or lack the vocabulary, because they certainly know how to get their point across. And that's the great thing is how these characters are written and how they communicate.
Yeah.
It's just point, that the cursing's a byproduct. It's kind of like, we throw these in just to kind of punctuate the point.
I agree. Oh, totally. And I think that the character of Swearengen being the one who uses cursing the most, he really is who he says he is, but he's also playing a role. Like, the character himself is playing the role of, you know, the bad guy, the bad boss, the guy who runs the town, who runs the whores. And I think that he kind of overuses bad words to get more attention and to play that role more convincingly. Like, the few times in this show when we see him with his guard down, he doesn't not swear, but you can see that there's a difference between who he is at, you know, at heart, and sort of the role that he plays to run this town with. And I think that the swearing is very much part of that character.
It's like wearing, it's like a hat, wearing a badge or wearing a hat, right? It's like,
if he wasn't using the F word, he was at least still calling everyone a whore or a bitch, you know? He was, no one ever is shown to be invincible. I mean, all of them are having heart attacks or, you know, kidney stones or other shit just going on, especially with him, you know?
Oh my goodness. No.
And I like how they show the awkwardness, but never like to a point where it just feels like an exploitation or just taking too much advantage of the freedom of it being on a satellite channel. It's like, this was all planned out. This is always in their blood to tell these kinds of, you know, anthology stories, you know?
Yeah, and you see that like Lindsay was saying with Swearengen with the preacher, how you know, he had no time for the preacher, but when the preacher got sick, he, you know, or wanted to sit and listen to the piano, he's like, okay, you know, that's fine. And then when it was time for him, it was a mercy killing, but he kind of did what he had to do. understanding that he was going to suffer, and it was a very difficult and just touching scene, but you could see the way Ian McShane played it as well. Because at the end, when the preacher died, he's like, you know, rest easy, brother. Like, he wouldn't, if he didn't care about that, you know, he wouldn't have saw him off that way, for lack of a better term. You know, he would have just had someone kill him. Mm-hmm. But you know, there are those flashes of caring, and the cursing is that bravado, and it's that front. Absolutely, Lindsay.
Yeah.
And it's funny that they're not afraid to poke humor at, you know, make it aware. So like Wu, the character of Wu comes in, you know, cocksucker, you know, like, and they play that up. It's a joke, then, like, because everybody talks this way. So that's the only piece of English he knows. that's a little bit of, that's funny there. And then there's one point where,
especially the whores.
One of the characters says, do people really talk like that? In one episode, I think it's the,
the mayor, Eve Farnham says it.
The mayor, Farnham. Yeah. Yeah.
That's right, guys. Before people were live tweeting, people were getting wind of people talking shit, so they would address it subtly. Work for the show, and it's like, but that is ballsy, and that is cool that they went there. And I've never seen Powers move this diabolical out of all the bad.
Oh my goodness!
Came close in Tombstone. He out Tombstoned himself in this.
Yeah, movie. I agree. Yeah. I definitely agree.
I think his work in Tombstone got him this role. Absolutely, Curly Bill is like this guy's cousin.
Yeah.
Well, I knew he was going to give Swearengen a run for his money. As soon as he came to town, I was like, okay, here we go. Yeah,
and I love how they set the two actors up against each other too, because Ian McShane plays Swearengen in this kind of, like, he works hard to appear unsophisticated, but he is quite sophisticated, quite intelligent, and clearly brilliant. And so when they had, you know, his rival show up in town looking very sophisticated, like, he's everything on the outside that Swearengen is on the inside. It was a perfect matchup.
Yeah, so true. I mean, it is showing you how basically back then everyone was about the looks, and that's just, that speaks to society. Is like, we judge how everything looks still. We just can't help it.
Can I go on a brief tangent here about looks? I've been thinking about this.
Go for it.
I think that one of the coolest things about Deadwood generally is that it actually really makes characters out of the prostitutes.
Yes.
You get to know them and you see them in their daily work, right? You get a real feel for what their lives were like. And so much of the time in Westerns, and really anything from, you know, ye olden times America, you get maybe an idea, you see little glimpses, but you don't really feel like you understand the lives that these women were living.
It was always easy titillation. It was like, we want someone to undress in the scene, so here we go. And it's like, but
right,
no,
exactly.
This one shows that every other kind of person in undressing is like, yeah, they...
One of the cool things that Deadwood did was, like, they allowed nudity on the part of the prostitutes to just be part of what they did. Like, it's not racy most of the time. They're just there, and there's, you know, a boob hanging out. Like, it's going to happen.
Matter of fact.
Right,
it's slow moving, but you know where the whole thing is going. You never felt like they were just on the fly. Well, what do we do next week? You know, it's like... very carefully orchestrated, and I mean, David Milch is a very self-confessed gambler, so he's pretty much showing everybody getting kicked out, you know, outside of the bar, having lost a gambling thing, and it's like, there's never any glamorization of that either. It's like, and I really hate how every other movie had to be set in Vegas for the longest time, and just be like, oh, look at what I won. It's like, yeah, well, you're one in how many?
Yeah, in Deadwood, the house always wins, no matter what.
That's more realistic. The only way
you're not walking out with money, because you'll take it in credit. They're giving out credits, like people bring in gold. Can I have credit for booze and women? Sure. So, you know, it's kind of, can I have credit for the craps tables? Sure. So all the money all the money just stays in these saloons anyway. It doesn't really go too far.
Pay to be robbed.
Yeah.
What did you think about how Harry Manning, his name is actually John Manning, the barman at the Tin Saloon, who later becomes one of the crooked cell keepers at the sheriff's jail in the movie, I thought that was a total turnaround, and I thought that was just the wise idea for the movie to go, because like the movie, most movies are just often just an extended reunion special and just nothing to really think about unless you're a hardcore fan. And I liked how it was kind of a standalone Western, but it included flashbacks whenever necessary. And yeah, like having it be all about preventing one giant lynching and taking down some of Hearst's mercs for hire, I thought that was the best way to go.
Yeah, and it was a quick throwaway line too. And during that scene when that character's coming in to kill Franklin AJ's character, and he says when the other guy comes in, he goes say you saw me trying to kill him, and it happens so quick that you almost don't hear it because he basically confesses that he's in on the kill, you know, on the setup. I thought it was kind of like a very quick throwaway line. It's like, yeah, say, you know, and he's like, hit me on this side of the head. It's like, wait, what do you mean hit you on this side of the head?
wait, back it up a bit. Yeah. Brilliant casting there by Don Swayze. That's right. Patrick's
brother. Yeah, he was the other guy. Yep. Yeah.
There was him and there's some other guy playing one of the other gun guys, but I liked how it kind of even related to today, you know, how we're just capturing crimes on, you know, we needed a phone back then. And it's like, and this went back to the typical, well, the black guy was there, so by default, he is guilty, you know, because of prejudice back then.
Yeah.
Even in Dakota. And so like, it was a good motive and race against time scenario. And it's just like, yeah, that. And I do like how, again, just everyone is vulnerable, like you've all been stating, is just like, Seth is a marshal, but there's plenty of times where he loses it and where he would, you know, in reality, probably, you know, get sued or get beaten up and someone else would take his badge and become sheriff for a day. So, yeah, it's just like no one ever feels safe. I mean, I like how Mrs. Bullock, Martha, you know, is just like she's not sure if she wants to even bring Calamity Jane to, you know, teach for a day because she's like, I hope you're not going to use too much colorful language for the kiddos. Just taking a trust in the most unlikeliest of people.
Can we just take a moment and appreciate the character of Calamity Jane in this show?
Yep. Absolutely.
I just absolutely fell for her completely. And actually, going back a little bit to the issue of appearance, I really thought that in Deadwood especially, you see the difference between the appearance of the prostitutes and say the widow Garrett, right?
Yes.
And Mrs. Bullock, and you know how completely opposite ends of the appearance spectrum they appear on. You know, the women with money and status, like they never have a hair out of place in public. They're
totally.
And they are dressed head to toe, like you can't even see their necks most of the time. And
that's very true. Both Bullock and Garrett, you know, just both opposites ends, the men marry out of respect to care for the widowed, you know, and
And these are the women who have men looking out for them, who have money, who have the respect of the community. They are completely covered up. And that's how things were in these times, in Victorian times, you know, like a woman's ankle, like if you showed an ankle in the wrong place, they thought like heads would explode, you know. But meanwhile, on the other end of the spectrum, you have the prostitutes who, you know, they're tits are hanging out and nobody cares. And then in the middle of this, you have Calamity Jane, who is kind of on neither end of the spectrum, wears men's clothing, doesn't do anything to make her appearance palatable to anyone.
Yeah, you do kind of got to get the sense she kind of had to buck up. She was tired of having to beat every guy within their life when they were hitting on her. So yeah, that tells the story all there, you know, just the rough and tough time. I mean, even when the Earp brothers visit, you know, much like Jane, they were always kind of portrayed as just a gunfighter who ends the saga, you know, in a episode of TV or in a movie. And it's like, no, they're just a spectator. And sometimes they participate and other times they don't. But yeah, in Jane's case, she basically, it was so cool to see her kind of go on her own adventure in the movie. And, you know, much in the show, she kind of was just also just kind of finding the most unusual friends and just honoring Wild Bill.
Yeah. And she did develop in a realistic way. It's not like by the end she was sober and mm-hmm. and had turned her life around, but she had, you know, the character had progressed through the seasons of kind and of dealing with some of those things and too, help, you know? Being a help and helping out and, you know, doing all those mm-hmm. kinds of things.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned the Spectrum. One character that hasn't been mentioned yet is Joni Stubbs, and she's
Yes, sorry.
You know, she is the well-to-do prostitute. Looks mm-hmm. very much like, you know, Alma Garrett. She's yep. her hair is perfect, Dickens. You know. Yeah. But you see her character go from that to, you know, she's sleeping with a couple of prostitutes in the bed, and you really do see a different side of her unfold in this thing yeah. too.
They do.
So it's
they
like, you know.
Very
and of course the relationship that she has with Jane. So, mm-hmm. you know, so
how many of them are underage? Yeah. How many of them are, you know,
yeah.
just doing this just to get by. They're not actually serious about it. So their heart's not in it. So therefore they're not giving it their all. And yeah, I mean, I can't think of any other stone that wasn't unturned in this whole predicament, especially on that scenario. I like how everyone can be like annoying one episode and then funny the next. It's just like, well, that's that adds a extra set of realism to it. I mean, William Sanderson from Blade Runner, I don't think I've ever seen Evie be even yeah. more annoying. And then by the movie, he's now the mayor. I'm like, well, okay, someone had to take it, I guess. That makes sense.
I don't think there's an episode where he's not getting under somebody's skin or something. like even when he doesn't try, even when he's like innocently just doing something, people just have no tolerance for.
Even you know, Al gets sick of him after a while.
He's like a walking worm. Like everyone right. just absolutely just hates
I just
him.
Love
he's
the
like,
fact
come
that
on, he's like gum on the shoe.
Yeah,
you know,
so, totally.
Get away, get off.
And you sit on my bed and try not to bleed.
You mentioned his character in Blade Runner. It's like his JF. He's gone by a different, you know, set of you know letters there. But it's like it's essentially the same character. Like he's the, you know, the sap. You know, like he just gets totally. Basically, yeah. So.
He was getting out of B movie territory.
Oh, this was a who's who of like real great character actors. I mean, it's just you know, and it was great to see them do something special like this. And
I wonder
like
how
said
many
before,
times a day they had to shave or you had to keep this beer for a month.
Right. Yeah.
You gotta look like a hobo.
Oh, especially God, I can't remember his name. The guy who never talked, but he always wore suspenders.
Oh, the older gray guy. Yeah, I think he passed away before this movie came out. But yeah, it's just so funny how darkly funny. It's not funny, but much like most of this is all darkly funny. Yeah, Evie will be yelling at him because he's always been picked on. So yeah,
what
do you do? The bully pick on the others beneath him.
Yeah.
And it's like often the guy will sometimes just walk away halfway before he's talking. He's like, I know what to do.
Love that character.
Oh, man. Yeah. So,
did we like Keith Carradine as Wild Bill Hickok? Did you feel like he nailed it?
This is such an underrated role for him, I think. But yeah, you be the judge. I mean,
I think it definitely
took off his TV career because, I mean, he had always done all kinds of independent movies and TV movies, but yeah. I think this was, you know, I think this is what got him the roles on other stuff like Man of Secretary and Fargo for sure.
I just wish he was in just a couple episodes more. I was like, you know, just way too early, you know, it's like, damn it, let's stretch this out a little bit, you know, but
yeah, they really left you wanting more with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, just the way he bounced off the other characters, how he was a calming influence to Jane.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, Jane was like at his feet all the time and Charlie would be bugging him and you mm-hmm. know, just he just wanted to be left alone and just kind of was knew that he was at the end of his career. So he was just a melancholy character, and Keith Carradine is normally known for playing like these easygoing, easy breezy type, type things.
Guy.
And this was, he was just a tired person, you know, and found that kindred spirit in Seth Bullock, that they're men of the same cut, you know, I think they mm-hmm. weren't, you know, and that Wild Bill was only ever meeting people that said, I saw you somewhere or wanted his autograph and just wanted to exist. And not be burdened by his notoriety.
And I totally kept expecting his brothers to make an appearance or two.
Yeah, like the Long Riders.
Exactly.
Oh, that was a good one, too. Yeah.
He basically still is in Long Riders mode. You keep, because, I mean, except he just drinks more. He doesn't even start a fight or anything. He just looks on and say, and are you going with your belongings or am I going to have to kick you out?
But they never let, you know, these characters never let you forget them. His spirit never. Is throughout the whole show. He's always mentioned. He's always there. His presence is felt, especially through Jane and Charlie, you know. So there's always recalling that, you know, because they were, you know, they were family, you know, in a sense. So it's like, you know, so, but see, Seth, you know, like Bullock actually hardly knows the guy. I mean, they just met and to see him like.
He made an impression. So you made
him cry. Like with that it was such a heartbreaking scene. Just my goodness. Like this just happened so suddenly. And he's like tearing up over this guy. It's like, because they there was that kinship there, that unspoken, like Dean pointed out, you know, there was something that they connected with there. And there was a sort of a, maybe a spiritual thing. I don't know, or something like, you know, it was the, you know,
he saw, spiritual.
He saw something in Seth that made about himself that maybe him came alive just a little bit in this existential crisis that he was going through at this point. So he kind of felt a little, you know, and it's and that's the moment he gets killed. It's like, damn it.
You know, and I love what you said about how like the shadow of him being killed in Deadwood kind of extends over the entire series. And I actually think that's kind of true about the real town of Deadwood too. Like, I mean, it's what 50 some years later, and they still do a reenactment of him getting shot in that town.
There you go.
I mean, I think there's a lot to be said about how much Wild Bill was an embodiment of like the idea of the Wild West. And
totally.
I mean, the time at which this show takes place is the mid 1870s. And that really was kind of the height of the Wild West. But it was almost the moment where the dream of the Wild West sort of overshadowed the reality of it. Feel like the fact that, you know, Wild Bill was killed in this, you know, typical but not exactly glorious way, during a card game, you know, shot in the back, and it kind of crystallized a moment of what the Wild West was and could be and was supposed to be. And it made Deadwood like mean something that it didn't before. And I think that the way that they, you know, continuously were talking about him and you just felt him throughout the show really says something about like how, I don't know, in that moment, something was gained and lost for the way that we think of the Wild West. And I don't know, it fits right into the tragedy of the show.
I think it, because it had to, I mean, just realistically speaking and just, you know, for a story standpoint, is just like, if all you're used to seeing is just people beat each other up and some other violence escalating, is like eventually you just kind of just, I think that's just it. Everyone had to just say, well, I'm just going to get comfortable here. Enjoy the ride.
I think when in talking about, you know, Keith Carradine and how awesome and incredible Ian McShane is, because no one could touch him in the show. I think Timothy Oliphant had the harder job, though, because he couldn't be over, you know, the villains often get the best lines and the best roles because they can chew it, you know, they can chew it up or not chew it up too much. Timothy Oliphant, I think, did most of his acting visually. Like he the character never says a lot, but the way he walks or and like
just gritting his teeth,
his body, his torso doesn't move. He like glides through crowds,
and just
the way he looks, he'll look from like the top of his hat, like his, because he wasn't a big name before this. He was in like Gone in 60 Seconds and some other films, but this was like a big role for him, and
I knew he was
to play the opposite. He had to be the opposite of the over the top Al.
Oh, totally. I had seen Scream 2 and Die Hard 4, but I I knew he was in this, but I, you know, I hadn't seen it. It was just one of those, like, oh, I've heard good stuff about it. He's getting talked about quite a lot. He's the shit now. He's appearing in everything now. And so when he got Justified, which, you know, I binged a lot during college, I was like, yeah, that makes sense. You know, he's playing a modern day cowboy, and then he's showing up on The Mandalorian, which is a total tribute to these earlier roles. Exactly. It's like
Boba Fett's armor.
Right. Yeah, I think what it is too, it's like, you know, like Dean pointed out, like the way he just, his body language is almost a classic Western trope. Like it's the tall, the straight laced guy, like just quiet, you know. So, but then they're at the same time they're subverting the cliches, you know, like we talked about Wild Bill saying, like, very much like Unforgiven. They're kind of,
that's a good point. I was going to say, I think
kind of like breaking those classic Western, like the romantic aspect of Westerns back in the day.
Totally. Unforgiven
down.
And that's
there's some similarities there. I think I thought of Unforgiven a lot while watching the show.
Cause
how,
I mean,
Clint, you know,
have you ever seen
tropes? Yeah.
Have you ever seen any other for hire, a gun for hire who just has to say goodbye to his, you know, kids and just say, and you know, who's widow and says, and you got to take care of the younger ones. And it's like, well, how do you do that? You don't really know. And it's just such a sad scene, but yeah. I think it definitely made so many modern day Westerns just reignite, and it just kind of sucked. Cause after a while, you know, there were so many bad Westerns in the '90s. I already mentioned Wild Bill before I'd mentioned this, which had Keith, and it was like, but I mean, the interest never stopped igniting. Is like, there was always, TNT was taking advantage of it. It was like, let's have a mini series or a two-part TV movie, you know, every few years. And I mean, you can tell Keith just embraced that, because I mean, he'd been in so many period pieces by, you know, Alan Rudolph and you know, Robert Altman. So I mean, I think all these actors were gonna just be used to doing some kind of historical drama. And I mean, I do like how Carradine, apparently, I do recall him hosting Turner Classic Movies, including Stagecoach, which starred his father, John. So.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, I think these guys are all going to go down in like the Wild West Hall of Fame, just because like there's considerable significance here.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And there really hadn't been a Western television series either that.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, you get Unforgiven, you get Dances with Wolves, you get Tombstone,
you get these one-off
Westerns that kind of revitalize, but you don't really, now you have, I think, Yellowstone, which is kind of like a neo-Western type thing, but
totally,
you didn't have a Western for, you know, maybe Bonanza or Gunsmoke.
Even Hell on Wheels was an answer to this kind of, you know, okay, so it's just like,
yeah, it was like the AMC version of Deadwood.
Yeah. But yeah, that's true. Everything else had to be kind of a neo-Western, where it's like we're referencing everybody, but they're in modern-day criminal or cops or clothing. Like Breaking Bad is basically a neo-Western, but it's a very minor comparison to what an actual Western is. Since neo-Western, it's got Western elements, but it's not a front Western.
I think it's just because it's set in the desert. I mean, that's really it's the look of the show.
That's right on the surface.
It's just more, to me, it's more noir than anything else, you know. But that's a remarkable show too. But
it was kind of another one, like, you hearing somebody talk about it was not going to do it any service. You had to actually seek out and watch it. Like when I heard, you know, all the potheads talking about Breaking Bad, I could have not even remotely brace myself for what I was in for. It's like, no, this is a very well done addiction. And yeah, with this, is like anyone else, don't let anyone tell us. I know this sounds kind of contrary, and since we're talking about the show and telling everyone else to watch it, it's like, no, actually sit down and make up your mind about it. Because I mean, people who don't like it, I mean, I've seen people who don't like Westerns like this show. That's how groundbreaking it is.
Yeah, because it's character.
Character comes first.
Character. It's like I mentioned before, like all the shows at this point in time really didn't matter what genre it was. It's not really about the plot necessarily. It's more about this really huge emphasis on character. Now, I mean, it's pretty much everything today as well. I mean, it's not changed.
Not even.
You know, it really kind of started in the late late 90s, early 2000s, with just the landscape of television just became more everything about character. It was
The ones that
going through about,
The ones that worried about content didn't last too long, but the ones that did actually make great use of their intense story, you know, they still have a fan base. There's still someone checking them out, and I'm glad the HBO Max app launched when it did, because it's like, well, okay, good, you got all your gems here.
And I think I think you hit on something with saying that you could probably take these stories. You said for people that don't like Westerns can watch this, you could probably take these scripts and put them in like corporate America with cutthroat companies and transplant it, and you would, and it wouldn't be right. It's not particular to, it just so happens to be taking place in the 1870s, but not, it's not directly tied to it, meaning it's the setting, but the characters are so compelling and what they're going through could be transplanted in, you know, the back and forths, the alliances, the backstabbing, the double dealing, all that could be put in any era and be just as successful with this type of cast and this type of writing, just so happened to have been in the West.
That's totally, you would like true. To think,
In this sort of no man's land kind of setting, you know, badlands. And I mean,
that's really what makes a Western, right? You know, like in the same way that a space opera is basically a Western happening in space, you have, the thing that makes a Western is that the action is going on in a place where there's nothing else. You're on some kind of frontier. You're on your own, and whatever happens here stays here. And I really think that that's one of the things that Deadwood did so well, is that feeling of like, there's this thriving community here, and we're actually all working really hard to make it work. And the reason that we're all working hard to make it work is because none of us fit in anywhere else.
Which
is the only place that we can be. And that's why Swearingen does everything that he has to do to keep this town running, because this is the only place that he can be at this point. It's the only thing, and he needs to rule over it. But
because that's so true, because you do feel like the town is very much alive. Even all the background players are really just, you feel like this is an actual town, because like nowadays, if there was like maybe a bigger respectable name, they would still just fall victim to just relying on casting big names and just kind of letting the camera just do fancy close-ups of them and just letting the actors carry the movie. And that just is a turn off for me. I really like it when you actually are thinking about how to detail some kind of significant life in something that may have happened, you know, and because it is not an easy feat. There are plenty of people who just can't seem to walk the right way. You know, it's kind of, I had some pals who were actual cowboys, and they would get pissed off when they saw someone. It's like, I can tell they're not a real cowboy because their belts, they don't even have a belt.
City, you city slicker.
My ass. Yeah. rolling. Nope.
Yeah. I think Deadwood benefited from having that lived in look, and it was all practical sets too. Thank God that this wasn't done now, where they would want to CG some of the back. We can CG the backgrounds. We could CG this.
Right,
This needed to have that muddy, like Eric said, that muddy lived in look to it. These people needed to look dirty. You can't just smear, like they legitimately look like they rolled around. It didn't look like someone just smeared a little on them, and then the rest of their face was clean. It was like Calamity Jane looked like she slept
in the mud
somewhere, literally.
And then she got up the next morning and she's covered in mud. Like, it's like, but she's sitting on a bed, or she might be sitting on a porch.
And everyone is sweaty all the time, which I really appreciated, because it gets hot as hell out there in South Dakota during the day. And, you know, Victorian times, everybody's all buttoned up all the time and wearing so many layers, so you can't smell them through their clothes. I mean, and I felt like they really got that, like, that claustrophobic, sweaty feeling of everybody wearing too much clothing all the time.
They feel trapped. Even when you see some of the guys showering at the coal mine, it's just like, and that's what happened, you know? There was no privacy, or, you know, one at a time, can someone use the public restroom or something? It's like, no. Everybody's got to take turns, and you don't like it, you get what you get. You know, it might as well be a prison, you know, it might as well be slavery.
That's really one of the things that I think made Deadwood the town and Deadwood the show so good, because the show appreciated this about the Wild West. Like, there, sure, there are people that are out there homesteading, right? People who just mm-hmm. want a new start for themselves and their families and go to church and everything. But those are not the people who ended up in Deadwood. Because, you know, like right. I said before, this was, they were not legally allowed to even be there at first. Like, mm-hmm. they were trespassing. And the people who ended up in these types of mining camps were people who had warrants out for their arrest in lawful places. You know, they mm-hmm. they came to places like this to get away from civilization. And I felt like just even the grubby feeling of the show and the aesthetic and the way that like what you just said, like it might as well have been a prison for all the privacy you had, like kind of makes sense. A lot of these people were running away from going to prison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is as good as it gets. So
it's almost like Casablanca, right? You know, mm-hmm. you think of that, you think of like all the refugees coming to together and having to live, or even Star Trek Deep Space Nine, where all everybody had to kind of live together on this yeah. crappy space station in the middle of nowhere.
Babylon 5, everybody yeah. is basically like part of a yeah. government, which is kind of forming a coup against itself and is yeah. like, who really believes in what they're representing? Yeah, I mean, you see many people who have to work on their manners and just all other sorts of.
But it makes for great that's... entertainment, though. Like you have these all these shady characters. You have, you know, you don't know what's up with this guy and that, and through it all, you get to know these people. They do have to kind of become some sort of a community, right? Mm-hmm. They and if you step out of line, you're gone. You know, it's like, you know,
yeah,
it's literally that simple. You know,
I love just, how. When they're even taking down Hearst's men, they're like, and he just ate here. And it does make you wonder. It's like, yeah, they could have saved themselves the trouble by actually poisoning him. But did anyone actually know how to do that even here? You know,
but that yeah. food, he's not too far off with EB's food.
Oh, that's true.
Until Aunt Lou came and started cooking.
That's right. Three. Yeah.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. Two.
Yeah. Aunt Lou.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Well, and something else I wanted to say, and so this doesn't really follow the conversation, but I'm just saying it because I've been sitting on it this whole time. is how much I appreciated, like, again, going back to the prostitutes. I have a vested interest in accurately portraying the work of prostitutes, particularly in, I think, Wild West settings.
They would always be like, no big deal. We're naturally in love. I'm like, no.
Well, because the Wild West, as we think of it now, relied so heavily on women doing this labor. There yep. was, you know, there was a brothel in every town because most of the people that came out to work on the mines or on the farms were men.
Everything was a degrading position, you know, and it just reminds you of how back in early Hollywood, how, you know, an actress or actor was not much different than this profession back then. So it's just like, well... But that was a step in the right direction, breaking through, just saying, you know, because especially when the stage manager, I mean, they kind of hint at the circus freaks that would have been out there. I mean, those guys also, once again, that's a degrading position too, you know, back then.
Well, but, I mean, depends on your perspective on it, I guess, because, I mean, it was a matter of survival for most people who were doing yeah, that yeah. kind of work. You yeah. know, they were getting by however they could. And once you had done that kind of work, you couldn't just reintegrate yourself into society, especially
yeah,
not back
like
then.
Everyone just forgets. And, oh,
right.
Yeah. It's like, and they do that a few different times when people are partying, like, didn't I see you at that saloon? You
know, right.
You're
yeah.
great. Meaning, but it means a whole different subtext. You were great.
Well, it's been really interesting. I was born in Montana. I was raised on the East Coast, and now I've moved back to Montana, where I've been living for the past 6 years. And within, I guess, about 3 hours driving distance of me, there are two different brothel museums.
Oh, wow.
Which are literally, you know, buildings that used to be brothels that are now museums. And I've been to both of them, and they're fascinating. And I've started reading books about women who worked as prostitutes in the Old West, because They're often portrayed in Westerns and in, you know, various types of Western entertainment, but they're usually an afterthought or they're something pretty
always
to look at.
Very, but, in fact, building on that, I feel like many of them, back when every other movie was basically politically incorrect, they would just treat them just so poorly, like they were just a body shield in one scene, no thought given to it. I'm like, well,
yeah,
that happened, but you're doing it very carelessly. Like, you know, you're not realizing how this was survival. Is like
they're not human beings in some cases. Yeah, they're not portrayed as. But yeah, the Deadwood did a remarkable job portraying bringing out the humanity. And but it's like, I wonder though. Here's a question. I mean, in today's landscape with the cancel culture and all this kind of thing, you think a show like Deadwood, this is a good, really great example. Could it still play out the way it did?
It could still work, but you'd be more tight-lipped. Like there was this one show on Stars that was about strippers. So there was Hustlers, and that earned J-Lo a award nomination. So I mean, but like you say, it might not be as easy to navigate. I mean, I haven't heard anything chaotic about behind the scenes. So yeah, the only black eye for me is just seeing Jeffrey Jones, because fuck that dude.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm surprised they brought him back for the film. But I was like, what is he doing
here?
They
didn't even need him. He just gave one speech that could have been delivered by anybody.
or just cut out even, I was like, what? That's kind of strange.
Huh. Yeah, I don't know. I guess they figured, hey, he's a shitty person, but shows up on time. I don't know. And that it does make you wonder how many people just say, I don't get the logic behind that. I'd like to think they weren't sympathetic toward him, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it was an honest portrayal of it was representation was there in this show. I think before representation, I think became a thing nowadays where everything's sort of grandstanding and, we have to do this and we got to do this and we have to show this. And I love it when people just did it back in the day without any, we weren't told that they were planning to do this. They would just do it.
They left them alone. They had names attached to it. They took a chance on them.
Right.
And like you say, they're nowadays, everything is just way too much. The studios are getting impatient, so they're just trying to appeal to the nearest investor.
We know everything that's going to happen in an upcoming Marvel movie. Like, we're going to have, a gay character.
2 years before it comes out.
Exactly. Before it's even written, even. It's like, we're going to have a gay character. We're going to have this, this person, that person, whatever. I don't know.
Anything that went wrong, we can digitally erase all the boom mics and the nipple slips and the.
If we're making Marvel comparisons, I'm gonna say that George Hurst was the Thanos of Deadwood.
He was a pretty shitty person. And it was funny how every portrayal of him wanted to kind of honor him. Is like, no. You look at the PBS documentary that came out lately. He is not a good person.
He was Gerald McRaney was the Thanos of Deadwood. Absolutely. He came in and everybody shivered and everybody was like, what's going to happen to us? He was the guy that could destroy everything with a snap of his fingers.
Right. That's right. Fantastic from that point, because he was a real bad apple on everything else from this point on, Longmire especially, I think is probably one of the best modern day Westerns.
Yeah, that's right. When Dillahunt was when he played Walcott and he was telling everybody that he worked for him, everybody was kind of like, oh,
right. Yeah, a year's first. Oh, yeah, you that's know. Like point. Yeah.
You let him do it.
That's
once.
Right. That dark cloud was already.
Yeah.
And it is funny how they would portray politicians back in the 90s. And nowadays they kind of, I don't know, they kind of overdo it. Like Designated Survivor was kind of the only one where I fought. Just felt unfiltered, because it was like, nowadays we got to kind of just have a giant rant. And it's like, no, back then they're just showing is like politicians is like, we're pretty greedy like they are today.
Yeah.
This is like no filtering that. And yeah, I can totally buy that. He probably had a few hired guns who couldn't trace it back to him. And he was like, get rid of witnesses that could testify against me.
Yep. If you had money, you had everything you needed, as long as you had money.
Yep.
Where there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah. And that's actually maybe something that really made the town of Deadwood and the show come together so much, is nobody really did have money there. there were people who were way better off than other people, but like everyone who started the town of Deadwood was in more or less the same situation. Like, you know, Swearengen is always giving people credit, or, you know, giving them like a free romp with one of the prostitutes or something, mm-hmm. or giving them free drinks, because money wasn't really the thing that anybody there had. That's why they were all there trying to, you know, mine for gold.
X amount of coins, you know, and which meant different value back then. But no, that's true. You guys did mention the credits earlier. It's like, I can't think of any other Western show where anyone gave any money prop like a second chance. It was always, well, just go on over to the wheel, we'll be right in with you. And it's just like, and I mean, you do kind of get an idea of, like, we're talking about today's society. I mean, I mentioned mental retardation. I even, you guys brought up stuff about the homeless and, again, the street walkers. Is just like, yeah, I mean, you actually do kind of get an idea of what was people even doing at in the middle of the night. They're just, you know, Kim Dickens' character especially is often just looking around, just knowing something is bad is going to happen tonight, and she's just kind of just bracing herself. She's like, yeah, something bad's going to happen, and she'll just look longingly into the skies like, I'm hoping something better happens later, though.
Yeah, just a feeling, a kind of a feeling of dread or despair. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like you lived in a time when, a gunshot goes off and everybody like runs to the window and looks, and they're seeing something, a scuffle out in the main drag or whatever. So I totally get that. It's just like, we weren't sure what was going to happen, especially like Lindsay said, this was a territory that was. They were run off by the Indians, and I think they mentioned that in the series that they were run off, but then they came back.
So you talk about
you don't even have the shadow of the government to protect you or organized government or anything. So you're literally out there fending for yourself. There's anything goes, you know. So you really got to watch your back.
I take that back. I forget there is that one Native American fight in season one. I think it happens around the 8th episode.
When he goes to the burial ground by accident.
That's true. Right? And I kept expecting whatever his name was, Red Horn or whatever, is like, you do kind of expect Bullock to get ambushed by another arrow or something, you know?
Yeah. At this period of time, I think it was around then. It was after the Battle of Little Bighorn Native population was expecting that because they had defeated the cavalry, that they would be left alone.
They'd back down.
And they were not left alone. And things were really bad. And there were Lakota warriors that would go up into the Black Hills and just hide and shoot miners while they were working. And just trying to kill enough people that the whites would be scared off their land. And, you know, it didn't work, sadly. But, it was very dangerous to be in that area at that time if you were a white person.
I could believe it. And I think that's just what the show does good. I mean, you never get a sense that everyone's too comfortable, because then that would just be just a flat out lie. That would be the Hollywood version of it. So,
yeah.
If this was a John Wayne Western, it'd be, howdy do, I'm going to go shoot some Indians.
Yeah. Right. And I actually always thought that it was really interesting how Swearengen. What does he call them?
I swear.
He calls natives like
dirt worshippers.
Dirt worshippers.
Dirt worshippers. Yeah. The off-color names. I mean, he can't. And that's the other thing too, is like, they're in on the joke. Nowadays, if a movie did this, they would just have all kinds of slurs, and you wouldn't be able to tell if the filmmaker, you know, was a bigot or not. And it's like, yeah, you totally get that everybody called each other just slurs back in that day. And so, yeah, he can't go up.
Well, I don't know. I mean, this is really at a time where, like, there was a extremely successful, you know, 100 years running propaganda campaign, literally trying to convince people that Native Americans were not humans.
And it worked, because
Swearengen was just like, the interesting thing that we see with Swearengen's character over and over again is that he is hiding his humanity and his sympathy for people beneath this character that he puts on.
That's true.
And I think that part of his insistence on calling them names is that he knows that he is on the chopping block. He basically runs this town. So if the natives take the town back, he loses everything, and probably including his own head. So
I would see similar promotion to The Sopranos, and like, I disagree with the Sopranos thing. I mean, it opened the door for stuff like this, but I mean, those guys are proud of who they are. He is not proud of who he is. You know, none of these people would have been. It was just, again, their way of existence. And so, like you say, he does always say people, call people in a off-color words, but it's in an, you know, off-color way. And it's kind of a, his way of satire, kind of joking to himself, because he knows, you know, not anybody, everybody is what they really truly are underneath. And yes, to admit any kind of humanity would to be kind of admit weakness, because he knows someone will take advantage of it or basically shank him in his sleep. So
yeah.
Well,
and in the first season, he's offering bounties for scalps when they when they
don't tell him if he even has the money, but he's just like, I want to set an example, you know.
Yeah, but I think it's also like fear. He knows that this is a dangerous place to be. He wants to establish himself, and so he wants to do what he can to keep natives away.
Talk the talk, walk the walk. Yeah.
The thing that they did do with the Native Americans, though, is when Seth got attacked, they kind of acknowledged. He said, well, I the reason why I got attacked was because I kind of trespassed on their burial area. So yeah. He kind of understood, and then you know, because he said he needed to be buried a certain way, and they made sure that they did that as well, too.
He was
so they
going
kinda
on a side mission and scouting, and he learned from the mistake, and he never goes there again. He rarely even goes out of town ever after that. And
So they did treat that part with respect, where Swearingen, they're, you know, they're heathens or whatever they are, but they did the time that a Native American did actually appear on the show. You know, he attacked somebody, but there was a justification for it. Right. It wasn't just murder. It was like, well, this was his sacred ground. And Seth Bullock actually understood that. He goes, well, I turns out that I trespassed when they found that structure that he built.
Yeah.
Oh, totally.
So I thought that was kind of interesting that they did acknowledge that.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's actually a really good point. And it also points to the fact that, like, I really think that they weren't working hard to make every aspect of the show historically accurate, but because at the beginning of the show, it's right after Custer was killed. I mean, they were right in the middle of the Great Sioux Nation in their most sacred land, is right where Deadwood is. Mm. And they're showing that the characters recognize this. It's not just like, oh, there might be some people hiding in the trees who might shoot us. They're like, there's literally an army that just defeated the 7th Cavalry.
They show Union soldiers walking in, but even them, like, they don't stay long. They're like, we got to get out and get back to work.
Right. Like, this is an extremely dangerous place to be. And so,
endorse me if I become a senator. Ha ha ha. If I allow to live. Right.
But it is interesting that, you know, like, the character of Seth Bullock is very respectful because, I mean, he came from Montana where the battle happened, near where the battle happened. He knows how dangerous this is and how much this enemy of the Americans needs to be respected.
Fighting.
And then you have Al Swearingen, who will just fling around epithets willy-nilly because he's trying to talk such a big game. It's really
interesting. Pretty much, yeah. You can tell Bullock comes from a respectable family who may or may not have been close to getting slaughtered at a homestead in the middle of Montana. And it's like Swearingen hangs around all the petty people, but he uses those guys to his advantage to keep them alive. And also, at the minute, again, money is threatened or lives are threatened, that's when it gets real. And if this was a Hollywood Western, a main like giant spectacle, it would have a miscast actor against a blue screen on a unconvincing horse. And then, he would be probably shot or whipped or thrown around like Arnold Schwarzenegger and then get up at the last minute to shoot Indian. You would be just like, what are you thinking?
I'm so glad we didn't get that show.
Totally. I would have been just like, fuck this. It's like, no, it doesn't work that way at all.
That's if Sam Raimi would have directed it back then.
But at least he would have been in on the show.
Like Evil Deadwood.
Evil Deadwood. We got that with Bristol County, but I know what you mean. Yeah. It's like, if this was we would have basically gotten something even goofier than Cowboys and Indians, probably. We would have probably, from Rennie Harlan. And the guys who brought you a bunch of other Jerry Bruckheimer shitfest comes.
the movie you didn't ask for, starring a bunch of old men who can't
Cutthroat Island 2.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would totally watch Bruce Campbell as Seth Bullock.
Oh, it would be awesome.
It wouldn't be not fun.
Believe it or not, he's actually thinking of bringing Briscoe County back. He said,
really?
Promoting Evil Dead TV show. So, I'm going to cross my fingers. Because that show was also a great... we even talked about that here. It was like, that was a good fantasy show.
Yeah.
That built its world and made it look real. And it's like, anyone else would have just been like, ho-hum, it's just like, you're just copying High Noon for the billionth time with a close-up of the church bell and guys going out for a duel. And I do like how we don't even get, it never becomes the duel show. Who's going to go out and do a measuring contest? So many of those. It just seemed like for a while they just wanted to just, again, pay tribute to the spaghetti westerns they grew up watching on antenna channels. And I'm like, well, again, homages are not the same as storytelling. And I think
that's where The Quick and the Dead came in from Raimi, right? That was just it's a great film, but that's one gunfight after another. That's all it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like a bracket of gunfighting.
Oh, totally. And I don't know. Half the time, it just seems like everyone's on Fast and Furious Expendables mode, where this is like they don't care what the tone is. They just want to make it quick and just let the fans eat it up who are going to be more forgiving. I'm like, well, typically I got an F in film screenwriting if I did shit like that and I didn't let people in on what I was going for. Whatever. People don't care when money's involved. So in many ways, you guys have all summed up. This is also kind of a breakdown of just movie making in general. You couldn't make this any other way. It would just be too long. It would flop at the box office, or it just would just have something that, it would have a bunch of actors who don't even look like what they say they are,
Yeah, I think they caught lightning in a bottle just at the time when this came out, where people were, before the splitting of streaming and just all the different ways to consume, HBO was kind of like the last bastion of sitting in front of the TV because they had everybody for The Sopranos each week. So they kind of had that last hurrah of before you were choosing different streaming things. Everything was so different segmented that this was cable. This was still kind of an event, for cable, where people were tuning into it. And like you said, nowadays it's going to be on some sub channel like Epics or something,
Said on Twitter about this scene. We're back to clickbait again, where it's just like, don't do it, guys. Don't even comment if you haven't even seen the movie or the show. Come on,
keep moving.
Move along.
nothing to see here.
You might end up dead in a bar fight.
That's it.
Or in a whorehouse.
Or get fed to the pigs. That's where you'll end up.
Woo's
and pigs. How many people ended up in Woo's pigs?
There were definitely. He mentioned he killed. I killed that one cocksucker. Yeah. So yeah.
Oh, that's it. You just went there. And I hope those pigs were not used for bacon. They never really said if those pigs just were pigs just for eating.
Eventually used for bacon, especially back in that day. Because it does seem like, come on, look at today's world, we're still having the argument over factory farming. So yeah, I can totally buy that. They were eating shit and being shitty people on their bacon.
What else would a pig be for in a town like this? They're definitely eating those pigs.
Gosh.
But I know what you mean. And just like the argument of the horse, it's an interesting parallel because you kind of almost expect them to be arguing over property. Like, I get to sleep with the whore tonight. It's like, no, they're arguing over the horse. And the guy who wants it doesn't even want it. He just wants it just because he spites, anyone who's black,
Yeah.
And so those were, they're all great, interesting side missions. There's no need to even do a movie version of the video game Red Dead Redemption. This is it.
That's it. You got it here.
All that was missing was a Native American with muscles named Grizzly, and you would have had.
And there you go.
Oh, man. So I feel like you guys have summed up just as best as we can all the themes. We didn't even talk about the tragedy of the boy that brings all these
various people to get her, but I mean, that's okay. I mean, we still pretty much talked into how it was like this went an unusual direction, and I don't think you could even script anything like this ever again, just because, I don't know, someone would just want to just take a shortcut and it just wouldn't look like any kind of history or chapter.
It just seems so, it doesn't seem that long ago either.
And no, it aged very well.
You know what I'm saying? Like it just feels, and but you're right. I mean, today it's just such a different landscape.
I even saw someone give a ho-hum review of the movie saying, I liked how the show originally ended. I'm like, what? It ended on a cliffhanger.
It just ended. Yeah, that was like,
about to get assaulted and someone's going out for a duel, threatening blood, and you think that's an ending? That's how it all ended? Get out of here.
I actually think that Deadwood holds up really well, like well enough that I think...
Oh, no, it's still a great show. Yeah.
If it were to air now, I think it would still be well received. I mean, sure, there might be more backlash about some of the things that get said on the show. But I, you know, just after even the conversation that we had, I'm thinking about it, and I never really feel like anything that happened on the show would be what they call now punching down.
Mm-hmm. Correct. You know, I never felt like it was them just being too loosey-goosey.
Yeah, nobody was just being mean for the sake of being mean. Any character who was being mean to someone in a less advantaged position was doing it for a reason. And sometimes it was maybe a shitty reason, but like it fit their character. Yeah. And it never felt like the show was trying to
emulate other movies or shows.
Yeah. Or pander.
Or even say... Yeah, it wasn't pandering. It wasn't trying to please anyone. It was just telling the story. And I think that means that its integrity is intact. And I feel like it would still play pretty well today.
Totally. I mean, it's kind of like with comedians, you know, the ones who tell the joke well, let alone to the right people, you know, they get it, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty hard for this to go wrong, really. I mean, it seemed like everyone who saw it just, you know, it was kind of slow word of mouth. and like you say, I mean, it seems like it's been well embraced by the brand of the channel. It just was, again, they cut it, they just killed it too soon just because they weren't impressed with ratings and the costs. But I think everyone had like a decade to learn that is like, okay, you got to take a chance and you got to spend a bunch, because otherwise you're not going to get any viewers. You can only cancel so many shows before you do actually lose value in your...
And when does it ever happen that, what, 13 years later, they decide to make a sequel film? Like, you know, that kind of says something for it as well, that it sailed off into its good night and canceled.
Can we get the Rome movie?
You know, and it's kind of like, oh, okay, it got its three seasons canceled. That's it. And then it's like, okay, how many years later we're gonna close it out? So it must have meant something to somebody at HBO as well, or that they got everybody back together for one more go around.
Someone was listening. Yeah. I think it's a shame, because I think that is, since Milch has, of course, unfortunately, gotten dementia, this is it. You know, and
yeah.
Thank God we got some kind of follow-up. But, I mean, it's just like, it's one of those where it's just like, thank God they even got to get something done in the way. Because, I mean, HBO had done other movie adaptations of his shows, which I can't say I necessarily recommend. They were just like, well, we're just all back together having too much fun. And, like, I was let down by the Sopranos movie. I just didn't feel like it was a good standalone movie or a good just prequel. I was just like, so everything I came to see, I didn't even get. And this one, you felt like it was just a proper continuation. 10 years later, here's what's happening. Introduce a few new characters who you can buy, kind of, I mean, hitchhikers and utter unusual guns for hire who, you know, and everyone, and you know everything the minute you need to know it. You know, it's like so many shows now kind of just wait on doing too many guessing games to where you kind of lose interest, just because when the mystery delivers, it's not, it just doesn't live up to the buildup. And then you got other, again, like now it's cool to be both a TV and a movie actor. People kind of forget you were either one or the other. You didn't really get to do both often. Now people will shell out $30 million for a famous actor to be the star of a limited event series. You know, it's like, well, times have changed. People are getting more competitive and trying to have the competition stand out. And of course, studios hear each other producers' ideas and they get ideas and they follow up. So I hope, like you guys say, we can just keep having just some kind of edgy show that's just like legit. Someone wanted to tell, had a story to tell instead of whose ass can I kick in the ratings department, you know, next week. Who can I wipe the floor with, like all these people who visit my bar? And I like that too. Anytime there's a cleanup, they never do it just for gore reason or anything. It's like, yeah, no. Someone, you give an idea, it's like someone had to get down on their knees and actually, you know, say, I'm going to be soaked in filth all night long and get maybe 2 hours of sleep. This is before we had alarm clocks. And clean my bar by...
Yep. And scrub the blood off the floor.
Yeah.
A lot of scrubbing.
It won't come up easy. Yeah. We didn't have sanitization or anything. Well, thank you all. You tore into this cool chapter of TV, so thank you.
Thank you. Yeah,
this is fun.
Yeah.
Anytime.
Thanks for having us.